So, what's your relationship to public education?
I went to public school in all of elementary school. In high school and junior high, I went to two different schools. One was like a big traditional public high school. The other, while it was still run through the public school district, was a kind of like alternative program church school thing that was like something like a charter school, but still actually a public school. I did my undergrad at a private school. I did my master's at a private school, but I did my PhD at a public school. I teach at a public institution currently. I taught at the University of Minnesota when I was doing my PhD. And then also when I lived in New York, I taught in an after-school program at a public elementary school too. So I feel like I like have enough experience in public education.
You drank the Kool-Aid. Made the Kool-Aid. You are the Kool-Aid.
Right. Right. How about you? What is your experience with public education?
Same kind of thing. I went to public school all the way through elementary school, went to public school for middle school and high school, went to public school for college, and I'm currently teaching at a public school and did graduate school at a public school. And so part of why I think this is very interesting, obviously there's a lot of debate about kind of public school and its place and its funding and this kind of thing at the moment. There's lots of people saying, hey, we support it. We support this thing, public education. It sounds great. Education's great. I don't know if a lot of people know what it is.
Yeah, I don't think they do either. Is that, that's what we should talk about today, right?
Oh, man, what a great idea.
All right. I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is
The Office Hour.
Toby, you have three kids. None of them are, like, proper school age yet, right?
No.
They go to preschool right now?
Yeah, they are 10 months, 2 years, and 4 years.
Do you plan on sending your kids to public school?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Why do you plan on sending your kids to public school?
Well, I think that public school, at least at the moment, and this is sort of by design, and this is really, as I'll stress in this podcast, really the only design for public school.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot stress that enough, that when I say only, I mean there is no plan. Pretty much the only design for public school until relatively recently was to try our best to represent the makeup of society in the sort of birdcage of a school building so that people socialize.
Yes.
With all different classes, all different races, basically simply determined by whatever school district they live in. Now, this has never actually happened.
Right.
and it took a lot of work even to get to the point of pretending that it was happening. And that's really all the federal government does in relation to public schools, is try to make it seem as if this is happening.
Right. And it enforces a certain kind of ideal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Insofar as I like America, I like public schools.
Right. I mean, it strikes one as being a, you know, very automatically democratic idea, right? It seems to be wholly fundamental to all of the values that we have as Americans, ostensibly.
And it's worth saying, and so this is, I do research on education, public education, universal education, this sort of thing. Although my research is primarily in the British tradition, and I'll mark how the things I say are a bit different in America than they were in England.
That'll be very helpful. I've always been curious about how
the
British education system is different.
Really fascinating doing
research. Aside from watching, like, To Sir With Love, which I don't think is a very accurate depiction of its reality.
So it's worth saying, and this is something that I think is a very careful and interesting point. A lot of people are very unhappy. This part of the sparking moment for this is Betsy DeVos becoming the Secretary of Education. And it's worth saying that Obama and Betsy DeVos line up, like, on the issues in some weird and interesting ways.
Yeah.
So her two main things, the things that people find objectionable about her, are one, that she's a evangelical Calvinist, I guess.
Right.
I think I'm getting that right. And two, she's a huge proponent of charter schools and of voucher systems that will allow people to pay for their children to either go to a charter school or to go to a public school. And this is essentially
sort of intentionally, vaguely, and misleadingly, positively described as school choice.
Right, exactly right. That essentially, if the one thing that the federal government does, other than killing people, is to have like a big just money hose and just kind of spray that money hose onto the things that it likes, then it has a big money hose, or a moderate money hose for public education, and it looks like some people want to divert some of the flow of that hose into basically the private pockets of people running charter schools.
Right. And it's worth noting another major criticism of Betsy DeVos has been the fact that she has no prior experience working in schools or in education explicitly. Though she is not the first person to become the Secretary of Education with that lack of credentials, I believe. Both George W. Bush's appointee and Bill Clinton's appointees similarly didn't really have any experience in that field.
Nor will she be the first or last rich person who was put in a position of power that they didn't have any training for.
Right.
To take us way back, because if one of the things that we think is objectionable about her is that she is bringing religion into the public school system in a way, right, she said, you know, we should use the schools to appreciate the kingdom of God, this kind of thing. It's worth saying, pretty much public school systems in England and the U.S. arose out of parochial schools, out of church schools.
Right.
And at least in England, and this is pretty true in the U.S. too, part of what happened was there were all these laws that came into effect in sort of urban centers and factory towns and this kind of thing to stop child labor. This is one of the great events or achievements of the 19th century was to put an end to child labor in the West. I mean, a lot of it has just simply been shifted to the East. But we don't have small children working in factories at the moment. We have child labor laws for a lot of different reasons. But once these child labor laws were put into place, that didn't stop the fact that there were just lots of children in the cities.
Right.
And pretty much nothing to do with them because their parents were working, you know, 100-hour weeks at those very same factories. Mm-hmm. So the churches started taking these kids in. They thought, well, maybe we should make these children love God or something. lot of work. These kids are completely uneducated, now out of work.
Right.
Basically.
Unemployed children.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's the kind of social problem we don't really talk about that much these
days. Well, because of public education. This is actually exactly what they did. So they started putting all these children in these boxes.
Right.
That they called schoolrooms.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have anything to do with it. There was no system. They could kind of sermonize at them, but that doesn't really keep children entertained. It doesn't really do anything with them. It doesn't make them productive subjects in any kind of interesting way. And what's more, every church had its own ideology,
right,
as it still does. So there was no standardization. Standardization wasn't even a thought at the time. And so there was all this going back and forth. The church said, hey, we're taking care of all these children. We're doing this massive social good. We're reducing crime. We're, like, doing good things for kind of the health of the community and this sort of stuff. Hey, government, you should turn on the money hose, and we should start getting money for this.
Right.
And we should start being able to build specific buildings in order to house these children for these long periods of time that we have them. And the government was like, okay, that's cool, here you go, here's a bunch of money. But soon after that, because the government doesn't like spending money on things, they said, hey, wait a second. We don't even know if you're doing anything. We don't even know if you have children. Or if you're just taking our money and doing essentially nothing. And, you know, cue every Charles Dickens novel.
Yes.
From the 19th century.
Yes.
Nicholas Nickleby being one particular instance where he does exactly this issue of looking at a charter school type situation where somebody takes money. Although it's worth pausing there because Nicholas Nickleby is kind of a weird one insofar as there were already systems of education in place if you were like upper middle class or elite, right?
Like you're talking about the masses.
Exactly right. And so it's worth differentiating these things. Private school has existed for a very long time.
Yes. And they surely had their own systems of evaluation or assessment or bureaucracy that existed prior to this.
Exactly right. And things like technical schools where you'd learn factory work or artisanal schools or certain kinds of apprenticeship and tutoring.
Right.
Education has been around for a very long time, but we're talking about a very specific, weird, modern thing.
Right.
This public education thing. So they basically start rounding up all these children, and the government says, hey, well, you churches come up with some standard where we will know that these children are progressing, and then we'll pay you based on that progress. And the churches couldn't do it. I mean, this is one reason that the Davos thing is problematic, not because it violates some sanctified idea of church and state as being separate, but because churches can't agree on anything.
Right.
Even, like, members of the same church can't agree on anything.
I can attest to this personally. I mean, I did, for a time, go to a little rinky-dink school that was, while still officially public, was run within a church. And the outcome of that was I had a class of 15 students total, and only three of us, to my knowledge, have gone on to graduate from college out of 15, and that is pretty representative of the school as a whole.
Yeah, and it's worth saying that's not unusual in the least. A couple years ago, there was an interview with Margie Ferguson, who was the president of MLA at the time.
Uh-huh.
And the question was, well, now that you have more of a top-down view of the educational system as president of the Modern Language Association, and that they had sort of an initiative to think about how to line up high school education and college education at that period, what do you think? And she was like, well, it's so much more heterodox than I ever imagined it to be. There really is no system. There is no thing there. There's just a sort of confederacy of thousands and thousands of sort of like homeschool networks, private school networks, church school networks, things we call more or less public schools that differ vastly by the state and this kind of thing. And there are no standards. There's no kind of common, this thing that people have since come to kind of think about as like the common core that the Obama administration tried to bring into place. There's nothing there. There's no there. There's just this kind of roiling sea of random stuff.
Right.
Of people kind of tumbling up through the world with something that looks like kind of standardized curriculum at times simply because they've printed out worksheets over and over again. So anyway, back in the 19th century,
right,
when the government realized that this was the situation, this guy who's been, I think, weirdly forgotten by history, but he could have been like Alexander Hamilton, although Alexander Hamilton was also mostly forgotten until the musical. So up until...
Well, maybe you should write a musical about this guy.
Yeah, James K. Shuttleworth.
Oh, yeah.
So this guy, who was also a very religious man, and he's sort of coming into power as Secretary of Education after right after the Chartist movements, which were a series of working class movements in England, where essentially the working classes were like, hey, we're getting a raw deal, we have all these demands, we're going to start breaking stuff and making a lot of trouble if some of our demands aren't met. The demands aren't met, they're sort of double crossed in a whole set of ways by various politicians. And it's one of the saddest movements in history. But one of the results is that you end up with this incredibly unhappy working class for any number, I mean, for all the reasons that industrialism makes the working class unhappy. And James K. Shuttleworth says, as a government, it's our duty to make the working class understand that their interests are our interests at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And the only way we can get them to understand this ideology is with a vast ideological system of education that lets them see that it's possible for them to move up, even while essentially containing them to have almost no social mobility.
So Shuttleworth was doing the working class, you know, a solid, but in the effort of sort of continuing to oppress them.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And very English.
Right, yeah, very English.
So, right, know and accept your place, and here's what we'll offer you.
Uh-huh.
Like, this kind of education. And he created this set of experiments called the Bordersea Experiments at this institute. And it sounds great. All the instructors and the pupils lived together all the time in these dormitories. Every day they'd have these long liberal arts style discussions about all the different readings they'd done.
Uh-huh.
They did gardening together.
Yeah.
They did all these sort of physical activities with the idea of this weird kind of Paulo Freire student-teacher dynamic.
Right.
And they were all orphans. All the students were orphans. Because there were tons of them at the time.
There were a lot of orphans.
And it worked really well. And he was like, this is it. I got it. All we have to do is set up this style of classroom that's incredibly interactive, incredibly discussion-based, both physically and spiritually taxing. And then we just need a series of tests to make sure that we're reproducing this model everywhere.
So, before we get ahead of ourselves there, what happened? Why don't we have this
ideal model of school today? So the churches can't agree on anything, right?
Right.
And this makes it really hard because the government needs to know that something's happening before they spend money. And since there's no agreement about how to create a religion test, Although, you know, I guess we could use it for immigration control. There are agreements for like, oh, well, reading and math. We can test those things. We can test reading competency and math competency.
Right.
And so this whole...
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, here we go. Here we go. We're approaching modern education. There's this whole system of Her Majesty's Inspectorate that James K. Shuttleworth also spearheads.
Uh-huh.
And he, like, develops all these standards. He develops this kind of loose but also really rigorous system of inspection and this kind of stuff. And all money is keyed off of this system.
Okay.
The church hates this.
Yeah.
The church hates this so... Every church. Not just the church, because there is no single church, but right. Everybody hates this.
Why do they hate it so much?
Because it takes education essentially out of their hands.
Okay.
However, it also gives them a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
So there's constant, extremely, extremely kind of high stakes back and forth between James K. Shuttleworth and these various factions that represent various churches and parliament and this kind of stuff. And, like, literally, like, weeks before the thing goes up for debate, James K. Shuttleworth suddenly starts having a series of debilitating stress-caused epileptic seizures.
Oh, no.
And has to, like, retire from government. And his faction in government surrenders everything. And so his entire system is gutted. The only thing left is this sort of bare-bones inspection unit.
Uh-huh.
That each school gets to decide individually what the terms of its own inspection are.
So this might be tangential to this kind of narrative that you're putting forward, but how did the modern public school sort of shed its relationship or its explicit relationship with the church? And I'm asking that because that is, you know, one of the bigger criticisms of Betsy DeVos is that she, it sounds like, is trying to bring public education or, you know, back to this kind of parochial model in certain ways.
Yeah, and the easiest answer is to say it didn't.
Okay.
Like, as you see from your own experience...
Right.
The schools never really left the church.
Right.
What happened instead, so we've got this kind of tattered, bare-bones inspection model still kind of kicking around a little bit.
Right.
And what it does is it incentivizes teaching to the test because all your school funding is based on reading and math competency.
Right.
And so essentially what happens...
It's a corporate logic.
Exactly, exactly. And like any corporate logic, the further you go down that path, the more... things that aren't those things that make you money get kind of cast to the side. So it was just like people stopped teaching religion so much in schools because it wasn't where the money was coming from.
So essentially what you're saying is that the concerns being raised over Betsy DeVos's sort of religious inclinations are in fact not, they're definitely not a new thing. And maybe they're not even so much a return to an old model as they are just a kind of more explicit version of what is already the case.
Right, and it's kind of a smokescreen.
Right.
Because it, like, the idea of having a single ideological religion having some kind of pervasive influence on a school system, it failed not because... you know, some religious Napoleon tried it and was conquered at the last minute by, like, secular heroes. It failed because it just failed.
Yeah.
It just can't work.
Yeah.
It's structurally impossible. Now, the real thing that's going on, if there's a real thing, is this charter school thing.
Yes, I was going to suggest we kind of pivot to that.
Which is incredibly sad, because charter schools could be the thing that fixes education, if fix is even possible.
So, if that were to be the case, how would charter schools be fixing education?
So, all schools are just this mishmash of stuff. There's no standard anywhere.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, how you can get people to tumble into the SATs.
Yeah.
Maybe better in one place than another or
right.
something. But, I mean, these testing regimes are also profoundly corporate and their own depressing subject in some ways. Charter schools, what they're supposed to do is, by being separate from the system, although, once again, there is
and
no
system. And by the
system,
I mean, you mean, like, school districts? State boards of education?
Yeah, I mean, there's essentially various kind of borders and checks to figure out where the money goes.
Uh-huh.
Like, more than anything else.
Right.
And then there's other things like MAT programs and certain kind of training regimens, but those are also incredibly heterodox.
And so one of the problems then with this idea being floated around of giving the power of decision to the states is that at the state level, there's not really any kind of infrastructure.
Nothing.
Okay.
And this was both why everyone hated No Child Left Behind, but also why it was kind of a sensible thing.
Uh-huh.
That, like, we didn't even know what was there.
Right.
Like, up until No Child Left Behind's kind of massive testing regimen, there was barely a sense of what existed. And then this testing regimen was meant to sort of bring it all to light, let the federal government see what it was working with. But, as I said earlier, the problem with when you bring a massive testing regimen in and base all payments off of that testing regimen is that you're then not actually seeing what's there. You're just seeing a huge amount of people suddenly reorienting themselves towards where the money's coming from this new test thing, which can create, like, the vision of standardization or the vision that we can know something. But in fact, all we know is that there is a testing system that's been implemented, and this is how each district can react to try to grab the money from that testing regimen. But it doesn't actually necessarily tell us much. The one defense I've heard of No Child Left Behind is that it made it clear that there's, like, massive discrimination in the school system in terms of if you're a school that's mostly minorities, you're not doing well in these tests.
Right, which was certainly not the intention of passing that, but,
no.
Like, you know, that's something that we ought to know, right? And have concrete evidence of.
And so, like, right under Obama, we have, like, the Every Student Succeeds Act. That's all about kind of a series of Pell Grants and various checks and balances to try to, like, now that we know, we really know that, like, this is so imbalanced, we can now try to start addressing it with certain kinds of money. And Betsy DeVos and the Republican Party is kind of like, oh, whoa, we're addressing things with money now. Hey, what if we put that money somewhere else?
Right.
And so what a charter school is supposed to do, so there's very little sense of what's going on in the school system or what's working or what's not working. A charter school is supposed to be like a laboratory.
Right.
Where you develop the best possible hypothesis from the best possible information you have, and then you turn it into an educational ideology, and then you experiment with it, and then check those results back against the general results of the larger population.
Yeah.
However, the problem with the charter school idea is that there is no incentive and that there is no legislation to make that check happen. And the charter school, unlike public schools, is kind of a black box in terms of you can pump money into it, and then where that money goes or how it's spent is just a mystery. And also, because it's not public, the teachers don't get to be unionized, and there's not really protections for the workers and that kind of thing.
Sounds like a kind of ideal shell company.
It actually is, but it could be the Battersea experiment.
Right.
Right? Like, it could be a place where you actually test horizon creative educational ideology and then reapply that into the main system. And that's, like, Obama's also pro-charter schools. Like, there's reasons to be pro-charter schools, but without those checks and balances to actually make sure it's not Trump University, charter schools are just a way to kind of, you know, divert the money hose to somewhere else.
Right, which is the precise thing that Betsy DeVos has spent her career doing.
I, you know, you can't see into somebody else's soul. I'd like to believe that she thinks that she's creating this sort of both more equitable and more open and more experimental system that, like, the charter schools indeed have a sort of squint-your-eyes possibility of becoming. I mean, when people choose to homeschool their children or send their children to, like, Waldorf schools or Montessori schools, what they're doing is not radically different. And it's also worth saying those places tend to be not very diverse at all.
So, to sort of sum things up here, you know, I'm curious, as someone who follows these things very closely and, in fact, does, you know, real research on it, what are your maybe top three concerns for the future of public education now that DeVos has been confirmed?
What I'd say is, not that this has fully come to light yet, but disruptive ideological shift in terms of disrupting a public system that, while deeply, deeply, deeply flawed, has a series of checks and balances and forms of legislation to, in flawed ways, fight things like discrimination. that she will basically undermine the integrity of what little federal oversight there is.
Yeah.
To allow the schools to continue to be a reflection of the diversity and breadth of our society.
Yeah.
Because that's basically all the federal government does.
Right.
Is like, hey, let's treat these teachers not even, like, slightly below okay, and let's try not to be super racist.
You know, Toby, I have to say, this is an issue I thought that I knew a lot about, and now I know even more, which means I think this was a successful conversation.
I ranted a lot, but I think
you had a lot of important things to say.
Right, in a relatively short amount of time. So, I hope our audience has been publicly educated.
Oh, yeah. I think we're doing a good job of educating the public on the Office Hour podcast.
Thank God. I mean, or, you know, yeah. Thank...
You gotta bring religion back.
Yeah, thanks school.
Thanks school.
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson Bates, Burton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatax.edu. Thanks for listening.
Whoa, in a couple of days, they're gonna take me away, but the press let the story leak. Now when the radical priests come to get me released, we's all on the cover of Newsweek.